Robert hoped it wasn't going to be a mistake to take Kevin to Sunday lunch at the franchise. He was desperately anxious that the Sharp should make a success with Kevin, and there was no denying they weren't everyone's cup of tea. Was lunch at the franchise likely to be an asset to their cause? A lunch cooked by Marion for Kevin, who was a gourmet? When Robert had first read the invitation handed in by Stanley on Saturday morning, he was glad they had made the gesture, but misgiving was slowly growing in him. He went to bed with anxiety in his heart. Just before 8 o'clock on Sunday morning, a car stopped below Robert's window. He got up and put his head out. Stanley was sitting in the car, regarding him with tolerant benevolence. "You Sunday snoozers," he said. "Did you get me up just to sneer at me?" "No, I have a message from Miss Sharp. She says when you come out, you're to take Betty Kane's statement with you, and you're on no account to forget it because it's of the first importance. She's going round looking as if she had unearthed a million. I haven't seen a woman look like that since my cousin Beulah married her Pole." Robert went to the bathroom, greatly puzzled. What had Marion discovered? Betty Kane had slipped up somewhere, that was obvious, but he hoped passionately that Marion, in her anxiety to obtain evidence on their side, wasn't exaggerating some trifling discrepancy. He was to feel guilty that he hadn't had greater faith in her, both over the matter of Betty Kane's statement and over the lunch. He should have remembered how cool-minded she was, how analytic, and he should have remembered the Sharp's gift for taking people as they found them, and its soothing effect. "Have you told Mr. McDermott?" Marion asked him. "About your message, no, I thought it better not to," Robert said. "Robert," she said, looking at him with a quizzical amusement, "you didn't trust me. You were afraid I was havering."
"I was afraid you might be building more on a small foundation than it would hold."
"I don't be afraid," she said reassuringly. "It will hold.
You are invited to inspect the fatal attic, Mr. McDermott."
"Thank you," Kevin said. "I should be greatly interested to see the things the girl professed to identify. All her statements seem to me the result of logical guesses." "Yes, it was rather terrifying at the time, the way she kept hitting on things we had. But she did make one complete bloomer, and I didn't think of it until last night, when I came up to the attic to get something. Have you got her statement, Robert?"
"Yes." He took it out of his pocket.
They climbed the last bare flight of stairs, and she led them into the attic. Kevin inspected the view from the window. "This is the view she described?" he asked.
"Yes," Marion said. "That is the view she described. Robert, would you read that bit out?"
"From the window of the attic, I could see a high brick wall with a big iron gate in the middle. There was a road on the farther side because I could see telegraph posts. You couldn't see through the gate because it had sheets of iron on it. Inside, the carriageway went straight for a little and then divided in two into a circle up to the door."
"What?"
yelled Kevin, straightening abruptly.
"Read that last bit again."
"Inside, the carriageway went straight for a little and then divided in two into a circle up to the..." Kevin's shout of triumph stopped him.
"You see," Marion said, into the sudden silence.
Robert saw what they were talking about. The edge of the roof, with its small parapet, cut off the view of the courtyard before the carriageway branched. No one imprisoned in that room would know about the two half-circles up to the doorway.
"You see," Marion said, "the inspector read that description when we were all in the drawing-room. And all of us knew it was accurate, I mean, an accurate picture of what the courtyard is like. So we unconsciously accepted it, even the inspector. It didn't occur to any of us that she could not have seen it from here."
"Yes," Kevin said. "She claimed she arrived in darkness and fled in darkness, so she could have known nothing of that branching drive."
"My mother thinks this is enough to discredit her," Marion said.
She looked from Kevin to Robert and back again, without much hope.
"But you don't, do you?"
"No," Kevin said. "She might wriggle out of it with the clever counsel's help. She might say she had deduced the circle from the swing of the car when she arrived. Anyhow, I think it should be kept for the assizes."
"You think we should
Give them tomorrow and bank everything on the assizes, Robert said.
Yes. You have no evidence to put before the court tomorrow, so it should be a very short and formal affair. A parade of their evidence, an announcement that you reserve your defense, an application for bail, and voila.
This suited Robert well enough. Where Betty Kane was concerned, he wanted the whole story of that month told in open court in her presence. And by the time the assizes opened at Norton, he would, please God, have the story to tell.
"Whom can we get to defend them?" he asked Kevin, as they drove home to tea.
Kevin reached into a pocket.
"What is the date of the assizes?" he asked.
Robert told him, and held his breath.
"It's just possible I might be able to come down myself. Let me see, let me see."
Robert let him see in complete silence. One word, he felt, might ruin it. At last Kevin said,
"Yes. I don't see why I shouldn't, short of the unforeseen. I like your witches. It would give me great pleasure to defend them."
On Monday morning in the police court, three routine cases were disposed of. Then Robert saw Inspector Grant come in quietly and sit at the back. And he knew the time had come. The Sharps came in together. Old Mrs. Sharp was wearing a flat black satin hat, in which she looked academic, respectable, but odd. Marion, too, was wearing a hat, he supposed as some protection against the public gaze. It was a country felt with a short brim, and its orthodoxy lessened to some extent her normal air of being a law unto herself. Her black hair was hidden, and her brilliant eyes shadowed. Robert missed the black hair and the brilliance, but thought it was all to the good. She should look as ordinary as possible. There was a stir on the press bench. And then Betty Kane came in. Robert hadn't seen her since she'd stood in the drawing room at the franchise in her dark blue school coat. And he was surprised all over again by her youth and her candid innocence. In the weeks since he had first seen her, she had grown into a monster who had lied two human beings into the dock. Now he was nonplussed. He knew this girl and the monster were one, but he found it difficult to realize. And if he reacted like that, what effect would she have on good men and true when the time came? When the girl's name was called, and she walked to the witness stand, he stole a glance at the faces of those who could see her clearly. There was only one expression on those faces, a sort of affectionate compassion. She was wearing a cloudy blue outfit that made one think of forget-me-nots and wood-smoke and bluebells, and was further calculated to bedevil the judgment of sober men. What jury would believe any bad of her? He reminded himself of Albert, the waiter's account of her, the nicely brought-up girl whom no one would have thought of as a woman at all, and the cool expertness with which she picked up the man she had chosen in the Midland Lounge. She had a pleasant voice, young and light and clear, without accent or affectation. And she told her tale like a model witness. The press could hardly keep their eyes on their shorthand. The bench was obviously doting. God send there was something tougher at the assizes. No actress had ever had a better reception. She was quite calm, nor was there any sign of triumph in her account. When she was asked if she recognized the women in the dock, if they were, in fact, the women who had detained and beaten her, she looked at them gravely for a moment and then said that she did, and they were.
"Do you want to examine, Mr. Blair?" Robert was asked.
"No, sir, I have no questions." This was accepted without remark. It was taken for granted the case would go forward to another court. The girl was now followed by the corroborative witnesses. The man who had seen her picked up by the car proved to be a post office sorter called Piper. He had been walking up the London Road through Maneshill when he noticed a young girl was waiting at the stop for the London coach. The coach had overtaken him about half a minute previously, so he realized she must have just missed it. Then, while he was still some distance away, a car slowed down alongside the girl. She bent forward to talk to whoever was in it, and then got in and was driven away.
By that time, he was near enough to describe the car, but not read the number. He hadn't thought of reading the number, anyhow.
Then came Rose Glynn.
She told the court she had been in the habit of going to the franchise every Monday to clean the house, and on a Monday in April, she was preparing to leave when she heard screaming coming from upstairs somewhere. The screaming seemed to be far away, as if it came from the attic. She was going to go upstairs, but Mrs. Sharp came out of the drawing-room and asked her what she was doing. She said someone was screaming upstairs. Mrs. Sharp said nonsense. She was imagining things, and wasn't it time she was going home? The screaming had stopped then, and while Mrs. Sharp was talking to her, Miss Sharp came downstairs. They went into the drawing-room, and she heard Mrs. Sharp say something about ought to be more careful. She was frightened. She took her money from where it was always left for her, on the kitchen mantelpiece, and ran from the house. The date was April the 15th. She remembered because she had decided that next time she went back, the following Monday, she would give the Sharps her notice. Robert was faintly cheered by the bad impression Rose Glynn was patently making on everyone. Her delight in the dramatic, her obvious malice, were unhappily contrasted with the restraint and good sense of Betty Kane in the witness box. From the expression on the faces of her audience, no one would trust her with sixpence. But that did nothing to discount the evidence she had just given on oath. Robert, letting her go, wondered if there was any way of pinning Marion's watch on her, so to speak. It was unlikely she had stolen that watch to sell it. She had taken it to keep for herself. That being so, was there perhaps some way of convicting her of theft and so discrediting her evidence? Rose Glynn was succeeded by her friend, Gladys Rees. Gladys was as small and pale and skinny as her friend was opulent. She was scared and ill at ease. But the gist of her evidence was clear. On the evening of Monday the 15th of April, Rose Glynn had told her she had heard someone screaming in an upstairs room at the franchise, although there was supposed not to be anyone there. As he was driving the Sharps back to the franchise, Robert asked Marion, "Do you happen to know the number of your watch, the one Rose Glynn stole?" "I didn't even know watches had numbers," Marion said. "It was very distinctive, though. A pale blue enamel face with gold Roman figures." "We have not yet thanked you for standing surety for our bail," Mrs. Sharp said. "If we began to thank him for all we owe him," Marion said, "there would be no end to it." But, Robert thought, except that he had enlisted Kevin McDermott, what had he been able to do for them? They would go for trial at Norton in little more than a fortnight. And they had no defense whatever.